Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down.
Hello everyone, I'm Patrick Connor, and welcome back to another episode of Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. Just a minute, my boy Bryn Jonathan Butler, author and filmmaker, is going to be joining us, of course, as he often does, and we're going to be talking about a handful of things, but we're primarily going to be focusing on, apologize for the late recap of Errol Spence Jr. versus Sean Porter, but also, I'll make it brief, Blog Talk totally flubbed it for like 4 or 5 days in a row. Literally nobody like in the world that I know of could connect. Blog Talk dropped the ball big time. So apologies for that. We were supposed to do a recap a few days ago. Nonetheless, we're going to be doing a recap today of that and the rest of the surprisingly good Fox pay-per-view card that happened last weekend. And then we're also going to be talking a little bit about Gennady Golovkin versus Sergey Derevyanchenko. And that is this weekend on DAZN. Very respectable fight, I would say. So as soon as Bryn gets in here, we're going to be talking about a lot of that stuff. First off, I'm going to go ahead and put it on out there. The other day we had started doing an episode when the technical difficulties literally just swooped in and cut the episode off. And what I was saying on that when I'd opened up the other day was that I was wrong. Straight up, people. Doesn't happen that often, or at least it doesn't happen that I'm going to openly admit it like that. But no, I was wrong. I definitely expected Errol Spence Jr. to outclass Sean Porter. I expected it to be a fairly dominant showing from him. I did not really think that it was going to be an exciting fight for a sustained period of time. I thought that Errol Spence Jr. was going to catch up and even possibly stop Sean Porter later in the fight. And I was definitely wrong. I think I was wrong on a number of accounts, and on probably the first and most important way in which I was wrong is that Sean Porter is better than I have given him credit for being. He was doing a lot of things in that fight, that a lot of subtle things. And on top of that, he was able to sustain that success for a number of periods, and he was able to really lay traps that I didn't really think he was capable of. And it's not that I thought that he was just some totally crap boxer. I mentioned even on the preview that I'm well aware that he has an amateur record. He's been fighting since he was fairly young, but obviously everybody has different capabilities. Just because you're fighting because you're young, or since you're young and have an amateur record or even a deep amateur record, doesn't mean you're necessarily therefore a good boxer. But Sean Porter showed that he got Errol Spence's timing down in a number of rounds. He was able to really force Errol Spence to come out of his shell, to take some risks. Errol Spence obviously got hit more than we're used to seeing him get hit, and so that was probably the most important way in which I was definitely wrong. What up, Bryn?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm just chilling here, admitting I'm Mr. Fucking Wrongy. Dude, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm finally glad we got to address this. We wanted to do it right away, and technical difficulties precluded it.
Well, and I said a minute ago, I don't know what the hell was going on, and I also don't really care, but it looked like a lot of people were really pissed with Blog Talk because literally for several days it was just down, including a number of our boxing podcast colleagues I saw were totally hosed by Blog Talk Radio. So that's bad news bears, but apologize for the late recap, but it just is what it is. That said, you know, it was a good enough fight that it's not like – it's not like the luster has worn off. You know, it's not like it was, you know, like there was two good moments and now we don't give a shit. It was a very good fight. It was a relevant fight. It was a fight that people are still talking about for a number of different reasons. But what did you think?
Well, I mean, I think you're doing it not a disservice, but I mean, I think quite rightly, a lot of people were pointing out that it was a fight of the year candidate. So I don't think it was like pretty good or exciting. I mean, I was watching it in Times Square with an audience of people like in the theater, and tons of people were screaming at the screen and filming the screen. I mean, I don't know what would possess somebody to film a movie theater screen portraying a live event. But I mean, I thought it was just a really exciting fight. I think at the end of the last podcast, as we were discussing some potential things that could take place in this fight, you had kind of the last thing we touched on was Vernon Forrest versus, remind me, why am I losing the name?
Not, it was Mayorga and Forrest, yeah.
Yeah, just making the point that the styles can sometimes come out of nowhere, and where Porter was so written off by, I think, most experts, if Porter just had a little bit better footwork, I think to be in a position to throw his punches with more leverage than he's able to. Those are big, sweeping sort of arm punches that he throws. I mean, I think Spence's stock went down a lot as a result of this fight. I'm not saying I don't know what the style matchup would be if he fights Terrence Crawford, but I think if people were looking for greatness from Spence, that's not what they got from this fight, and we didn't expect that. And it's not to say that he's not an excellent fighter. It's just he did not look great against somebody like Porter, who nobody really took seriously as an elite fighter at this point, I think. So I thought that was a big surprise. I thought it was thrilling to see what Porter was able to do throughout the fight. I thought almost every round was really exciting. There was a lot of danger for Spence. I liked the way Spence approached the fight as well, making it a fun fight to watch. I just wish Porter had a little bit more in terms of, a little bit better footwork to be more balanced when he was throwing those shots. And I think he would have stood a very good chance of putting Spence away.
I mean, I don't totally disagree. I think that there's just kind of a slight disagreement on my part. And I guess that's just that, I mean, I think that maybe I miscalculated. I think probably the most important thing that I miscalculated would be that basically I think that maybe – I'm sorry. I kind of got distracted just for a second. Sorry. I think the biggest thing that I was probably wrong about was Sean Porter is a little bit better than I thought in a number of different ways. And I think that maybe I possibly got lost in the losses a little bit too much, and the fact that he was seemingly outclassed by a handful of guys where if you look at them, it's like not a shame to be outclassed by them. And that's not to say anybody was shaming him per se, but I think that the miscalculation was, on the part of a lot of people, just that, perhaps giving a little bit too much credence to those losses. However, even so, even if that's true, I think the issue is that even if you were to say, those losses don't mean anything and they were to good fighters or whatever, even so, just doing the kind of eye test, as they say, meaning that, like, what is he able to do in the ring? It definitely didn't seem like he would measure up to Errol Spence. So in that sense, yeah, I think that it is fair to kind of knock Errol Spence down a peg in a way, at least in terms of in a potential matchup against Terrence Crawford or something like that. Just, as far as what they showed in the ring, Errol Spence didn't look nearly as dominant. But I think that, just pre-fight, maybe I just miscalculated a number of different things. Perhaps I overrated Errol Spence a little bit. Perhaps I underrated Sean Porter. I didn't really think that I thought that those hard fights on Sean Porter's part would possibly be telling too. I wasn't really sure that he was going to be able to be physically up for this fight, and I was just wrong. One of the things that I was saying right before you got on, and one of the things that really surprised me in the ring, was that despite the fact that Sean Porter just falls in way too much, and just kind of, absolutely, like, does that, he just smothers his own work far too much. And part of it is, I'm sure, just like tenacity. He's super tenacious in the ring. He just wants to launch his opponent. And I definitely appreciate that. But at the same time, it really just takes away that kind of optimal distance for getting a guy at the end of your punches, which is something Spence actually wound up figuring out much better later on in the fight. But one of the things that Sean Porter was doing that really surprised me was he was laying traps. He was actually kind of doing some pull counter action on Errol Spence, which surprised me. You know, he was out jabbing him from the outside at times, which was also surprising, taking away Errol Spence's jab. You know, kind of doing that little quick sidestep and then landing a hook. But as you said, just not at the right distance. And he was just kind of barely off. And on one hand, you could say, well, had he just been a little barely more on, I think he would have taken it. But also another way of looking at it is I think that Errol Spence Jr. is super skilled and was able to kind of take that angle away in some regards, especially late in the fight. But, you know, here we are. It was a very intriguing fight in that regard, but also action-packed. It wasn't some boring-ass tactical, you know, fight that only the purists, like, you know, fucking Pernell Whitaker versus Buddy McGirt 2 or something like that. But it was a fun fight that I think a lot of people could really get into. There is, of course, the kind of Debbie Downer argument that maybe that's not the greatest thing because it was not the best aimed audience for a fight like this, or I don't know. Maybe I'm just wrong all around here. I don't know. Maybe I should shut up.
No, I think you're right. I think there was just a real tenacity to what Porter was able to do in terms of applying his pressure, but I mean, it kind of reminded me, like, and we've touched on this before, but like it reminded me the way Tyson would smother people. The difference was is that as Tyson would smother people, he'd wait for them to fire back and then pivot off or use the what I've recently learned was called the D'Amato shift, where he'd sort of like leap in a very controlled way to an angle on either side and often switch his stance into a southpaw position to find a completely fresh angle to stun people. Did it against Marvis Frazier, a number of like his great knockouts. If you go back and watch them in slow motion, he does some of these moves, these tremendous angles he's able to discover as a counterpuncher. Porter has none of that. That's not his game at all. He is a pure pressure puncher. But I wish, like, I mean, if you had a trainer examining this fight, I would just get him to watch the early Tyson stuff just to make a few little adjustments. And I think you'd see like there was the potential for some big openings that he could have found. Instead, as you say, it was smothering, which nullified his ability to land a big shot. And those punches that he's throwing are just arm punches. So they just don't have the velocity that you'd like for a guy that's as strong as Porter, but he's out of position. He's out of position even when he's on the inside. He just doesn't know how to fight terribly effectively while he's there. So, the joke that Spence said about him, he looks like a guy who's drowning or something, trying to stay up. But it was frustrating because you saw just how hard he was working, having to accept a lot of punishment to do what he wanted to do in that fight. Similarly, Spence took more leather in that fight than I think he has in his next three most fights where he's been hit. So it added up to something that was really, really easy to engage with, I think, for everybody. And it was a great test for Spence. I totally agree with him winning the decision. Some of those scorecards were very odd. And the other thing about this, which we haven't even touched on, Patrick, is, and I think this is just empirically, objectively true, there were more low blows in this fight that Spence threw than Galata threw against Riddick Bowe. And nobody is bringing up that I've really seen that this referee didn't even fucking warn him. Like, the low blows were a major factor in this fight. And I have no idea why Spence was allowed to do it. What was the ref's name again? Reese? Jack Reese? Is that right?
Yeah, Jack Reese, who is he's a very well-known referee in California, or on the West Coast, I should say, but specifically in L.A. He does a ton of shit in L.A.
Well, he was fucking abject, terrible in terms of his negligence in this fight. I mean, Porter was just getting fucking teed off on his balls, especially early in the fight. And Jack either was out of position or just disregarded it. And I don't understand how a guy can easily take 20 low blows in a fight without it being a major factor in how the referee is sort of allowing the fight to continue. Because it just gave license for Spence to keep doing it. And I don't think that Spence is like a terribly dirty fighter, but these were not questionable low blows. These were like the end of Kovalev and Andre Ward, those kind of low blows, punching up to hit the balls in many cases. And I mean, I found myself like even just like calling it out, like 3, 4, 5, and then like 30 seconds later, 6, 7, 8. Like it was just so obvious. And I don't know. I find it interesting that you have a fight like Galatabo where everybody's like, oh my God, the lack of sportsmanship and just how dirty a fight it was. That's not the way this fight has been contextualized for Spence, and I'm not sure why, because we're not talking about 3 or 4 low blows. We're talking about over 20 in that fight, if you go back and watch it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. He was a little excessive with, I think, and this is just my speculation, so I really don't know, but it seemed to me like perhaps he was recognizing that Sean Porter was kind of getting to him, you know, and not outwardly doing it, not turning to the camera and going, he's getting to me. But instead, you know, his way of kind of recognizing that and combating it, at least in the moment, was to, you know, one good turn deserves another type of thing, and get physical with him and maybe overpower him a little bit, bully him a little bit. And it worked. Later in the fight, I think that he had successfully worn Sean Porter down enough to put him in position to land that left hook, and I think it was the 11th round, or that left hand in the 11th round. But yeah, I don't like to see something like that, whether it's low blows or rabbit punching, or you know, we see it somewhat frequently in boxing that one of these kind of extracurricular things winds up unfortunately driving at least part of the narrative. So yeah, I mean, it's just it's unfortunately that it kind of has to come to that. Although I do have to say also kind of attached to that, and also in response to what you had said earlier about how hard Sean Porter worked, and you know, kind of looking at it as a little bit of a disappointment in that regard, because he did work really hard and he did put in the work, and it not just in the ring, but in the gym and et cetera, et cetera. And then on top of that, he, you know, he's not whining about the low blows, neither in the moment nor after the fight. He's not whining about scorecards. He's not whining about, you know, I should have won that fight. The only interviews I've seen of him, he's pretty much like, yeah, it was a close fight. You know, I just barely lost. Who the fuck does that? What fighter does that? I mean, like, you know, any hatred you could have for the guy, you know, or any sort of criticism is just kind of fades away when they do shit like that.
Right. And it's so simple to be that way, right? I mean, just not to be not a sore sport, but you're right. Like, these guys seem very frequently delusional. I mean, even, you know, fucking Ali in the first fight, like, I'm robbed. He's not a real champion. And the moment the judges give him the decision, the next one, oh, the judges were on this time. They were just awful last time. Like, it's so selective. And, you know, it's pretty frustrating when guys can't give their opponent their due, you know, especially in a great fight like this that, you know, this was a memorable fight. This was a great fight for 2019, and both these guys earned that. I mean, I don't think many people expected, you know, there were sort of tepid predictions going into this that, like, it could be a little more competitive than we think. I don't know anybody who saw this coming, that it would be this action-packed, that Spence would be tested to this degree, that Porter would put on a performance like that. I just find the low blows thing just like, come on, man. Like you've got to not allow that to become as big a mitigating factor as potentially it was. And Porter doesn't play it up. He's not like a soccer player in terms of, you know, he's going to dive on the ground every time it happens. maybe he should have. You know, if you think about it in hindsight, had he put on more of an acting performance about the impact, could have got him a point, could have got him 2 points, could have got Spence disqualified, right? As I say, a lot more leather went low in this fight than Bo Gallada. And look at the result of that fight. So, I don't know. I think there's just a lot there with this fight to go back and watch and enjoy. And the knockout was just beautiful knockout. I mean, savage. And Porter just jumps back up and off he goes again, giving it his all. So, you know, there's not a lot of fights that you and I need to recap immediately because there's such intense pleasure about like the aftermath of a fight. This is one of those fights. This is really, really good for boxing.
Well, no, I'm actually a little bit relieved that we've definitely focused more on the good than the bad because, you know, I don't like to feel like I'm a frickin' wet sock, especially in the aftermath of a fun fight where it's like a good, generally speaking, for boxing. And, you know, especially even if it's just the conversation, you know, the trending or whatever you want to call it. You know, it's good to have people excited about the sport. But where it of course kind of turns downward, and I don't want to be like a bad guy here, but I had mentioned it earlier, and I had mentioned it on the preview. Look, paying $75 for this, even though it kind of like in hindsight wound up almost accidentally being good, you know, paying $75 for it's a bit much, dude. That's the kind of thing where if you're going to pay $75 for a fight card, like, you probably should be attending in person, or it should be really, really good. And while it actually wound up being pretty fun, again, I almost feel like it was an accident that it did. Like, it wasn't really necessarily set up to be a super competitive fight card. It was set up to be a win for, you know, a tough win for Errol Spence. And then, you know, later on down the card, it was kind of just like support. And I'm happy that that's not what it wound up being. I'm happy that, for instance, David Benavidez wound up beating down Anthony Durrell because I'm not a Durrell fan. You know, and I thought that Batir Akhmedov probably should have gotten that win over Mario Barrios, but you know, it was not very nice seeing John Molina Jr. get the shit kicked out of him for the umpteenth time. But
that was brutal.
But nonetheless, you know, they were still fairly entertaining fights overall. It's just that $75 price tag. My concern is that in retrospect, with 2020 hindsight, and the fights are good and people are like, oh, that's okay, it was worth your money. Then they're like, okay, good, we'll do $75 again next time. Well, shit.
Oh,
no, that's not what I was saying. You know, I don't want them to do that. I'm just saying that it wound up being good. And so, you know, there's that aspect of it, but then there's the overwhelming aspect of it. And this is, I'm sure you would agree, we talked about it in the preview as well. One of the main talking points in the aftermath, if it's not about how good the fight was, is about how little we expect Errol Spence Jr. to actually face Terrence Crawford, especially now. I mean, with that being a good fight, they could do a rematch. So that's simply just another option to do rather than go for Terrence Crawford, which sucks.
Right. Yeah. Well, even Danny Garcia, I don't give a fuck about that fight particularly.
I hadn't even gone to that part yet. Oh my gosh. I almost had a meltdown when that happened because I just, Danny Garcia is so Adrian Bronery to me, man. I just can't stand the dude.
Yeah.
So to see him step into that interview, I was just like, no.
Yeah, it was a pretty obvious tipping the hat to where it was headed, but I agree with you. And I don't think it's us being, you know, Debbie Downers about this. The price point was bad. This should have been on regular TV. This is exactly the kind of fight they should have on TV, and they should have a lot more of them so that the excitement of this can drown out some of the ones that are stinkers, because this is a fight that's going to get people as a gateway drug into watching more boxing. Is a fight like this seen by as many eyeballs as possible is going to be good for who's ever showing it. It's going to be good for casual boxing fans to get hooked on it. And it's ultimately going to be good for Porter and Spence down the road, because they're going to develop a fan base if they can keep doing stuff like this. producing a product that's this exciting, where their brand becomes associated with, you got to see who they're, you got to see them fight, regardless of who they're fighting, because they're going to put on great fights. And instead, a $75 price tag for something that, in my view, should be on TV, is an annoying thing. And I think you're absolutely right, is that the marketers are going to take this to be the rule rather than the exception of what a lot of pay-per-view fights have proved to be, where they've got your money and they're happy, but like the feeling with customers is that they've been a little bit ripped off. And I'm not saying that they were, I mean, obviously they were not ripped off with a fight of the year candidate like this, especially one that was so unexpected, but this is going to be the exception. You know, like most of the time on paper, a fight like this is not going to go the way it did, which is why it's garnered the kind of admiration that it has. But yeah, I don't, it's frustrating that it's going to go, I think, to your point, very likely that marketers are going to say, you know, see, there's a good reason, like we know what we're doing. And they're just going to play off, you know, when they get it right, 1 out of 10 times, that they, you know, are great prognosticators of price point. But I thought it was a terrible price point.
Yeah, it's just, it was not in line with reality, really. And I'm not going to call out anybody by name, just because it's, there's no point in that. And that's just, nothing good is going to come of that. But you know, I also have noticed, and it's not like I've only noticed in the wake of this fight, it's definitely been something of a trend for a number of people, not only in media, but, you know, surrounded kind of in the periphery of media and whatnot, even if they are just people who generally write, for the most part, press releases. And hey, dude, there's a place for those people too. I don't mean to disparage them per se, but nonetheless, there's definitely been a sort of like a cult who will do anything to spin whatever the result is to something that is positive and means that that was the whole fucking plan all along. And, you know, it's very fly-by-night-y. And then, little Rush reference for you there, Mr. Canadian. It's just very, it's haphazard. But then on top of that, it's like when it winds up, however it winds up turning out, it's like, that's how we meant to do it the entire way. And the defense of the premier boxing champion business model, as it were, is, it's just weird. I mean, am I wrong? Have you noticed this? And if you have, am I wrong?
No, I think, I don't think either of us are especially cynical about the sport of boxing. And I think, you know, we're romantics at heart in terms of what we're cheering for is that we want good fights. We want more people to enjoy them. We want fighters to get paid well. I mean, like, I don't think we're pulling for anybody to get fucked over in any of this. Like, our agenda is pretty explicit that we want, you know, the best for the sport, to bring it back to prominence, I think, is sort of what I would like. And I'd like it to get there, as a result of people just talking about how much money has been made with each fight, but that we're getting great fights. And, you know, it's a consistent thing that you and I go back to over and over again, is as much money as is in the sport right now, it's got to be producing great fights. Rather than everybody thinking because there's all this money suddenly here from venture capital and really shady places, that it's just going to endlessly be coming and the faucet is just a fucking fire hose. But it's not. It's going to be here for a little while. I've heard some negative like rumors about DAZN, and once they get into other sports, like, how is it going to do? Is it really going to be as concerned with boxing? You know, Heyman's money, like the first huge stint of it, how well did it do in terms of producing great legacy fights? So something like this, like $75 price point, and I think a lot of people just being like, that's a lot of money to watch something on TV. You know, like that's a lot. That, like, even to go to a show, that's a lot of money to spend.
Well, something that I had kind of mentioned when we previewed it, and something that's kind of been part of the financial discussion as well, is that, you know, I did some fairly rough math here. $70 times they're projecting 300,000 pay-per-view buys. That's $21 million, and then it's about $6 million or so going to, you know, the fighters. That's a lot of money left over that we don't really know where it's going to. And when I had said something to that effect on Twitter, basically the responses that I had gotten in defense of Premier Boxing Champions, more or less, was that, well, what, you don't think the fighters are making more under the table? Or what, you think that that's all they're getting paid? And the only thing I can think about that is like, look, dude, I know what boxing is. I know that boxing is like full of shady and shitty characters. But at the same time, are we really going to be like encouraging or romanticizing or something, or, you know, looking up to whatever, the fact that the fighters basically have to get paid under the fucking table? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Like, that shit should be right out in the open. There, we shouldn't have to be speculating over, like, who's so-and-so's manager and who's their advisor and who's this and that. Like, I mean, if it's on the up and up, generally speaking, people don't hide it.
That's a great point. And boxing in professional sports, it's the biggest black box that exists financially, you know? So... yeah, I mean, it is that way because, yeah, a lot of this money that's coming in is not money that really wants you to know where it's coming from. And, you know, we've talked about it before, but, I mean, over in Europe, like Ireland, there's been some situations associated with where this money is coming from that is, like, people are losing lives over it. And, you know, even, I mean, there was a Frontline special on MBS about Saudi Arabia and a lot of that situation. And I mean, if you are just hearing some people and you assume that it's virtue signaling over their objections with Ruiz Joshua being held in Saudi Arabia, watch this episode. Like, it's free to watch, the Frontline, the most recent Frontline, I think, came out last week, about MBS and his backstory and Trump and Kushner's dealing with him and legitimizing him and that sort of thing. Like, it's dark, super fucked up shit. And piles of women are just, like, in prison for even trying to drive a car over there. And I saw Eddie Hearn last night. There was, like, a presser for the Golovkin fight. And, you know, I was asking him about, does he think that, you know, where does if Joshua wins against Ruiz, is he ever going to fight Wilder? And, you know, nobody was sort of bringing up the Saudi Arabia thing. And yeah, it's, I just wonder where the sport is going to be in 5 years when maybe a lot of this money that's there currently is not there. And have they done enough with like over $1 billion of venture capital to sort of solidify what their objectives really should be for the welfare of the sport? And I don't even think they care. Like, you know, I think the Spence Porter fight and Spence immediately looking to Danny Garcia after is a perfect example of that. You know, the best fight that boxing can make right now is Spence versus Terrence Crawford, and we're nowhere near it being made. You know, we're nowhere near it being made in the next 2 years. And we're the sport where...
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, like, we're the sport where we consistently do that, that when we have a great product and a great time to show that product, of course we're not going to do it. And it's just incredibly frustrating that is how this sport consistently over long periods of time distinguishes itself, is that's what we're able to do, is give you exactly what you want, like present exactly what you want and then deprive you of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so, like, self-cannibalistic, dude. It's like a snake fucking eating itself. And it feels, it's just so strange for it to love a sport like that, you know, sometimes. It's so weird. And the kind of, like, even though I don't want to rehash what we've already talked about with the Saudi Arabia thing, nonetheless, I mean... just to kind of respond to that, the idea that saying something like that is virtue signaling, the idea of, you know, saying, oh, well, what about these other fights that were shitty or held in, you know, places that had dictators or something like that, like as if that's some sort of way to shut down the argument and say, oh, well, if it happened before, it's happening now, well, then everybody shut up because it's okay. Like, that's obviously totally illogical. And I guess a better response to that would be, well, we got to fucking start somewhere. We got to start caring about the ethics at some point, right? And I guess, why not now? I don't know. But, you know, the way that boxing just kind of shoots itself in the foot constantly is so frustrating, and especially when you have, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but in the day or two after Spence Porter, there was an interview with an executive at Fox, something Wagner? I can't remember his name, but nonetheless, he was quoted as saying that they're looking to make Spence Crawford in 2021. And I'm kind of just like, look, dude. You know, not every fight needs to be slow cooked. Not everything needs to be marinated or whatever term you want to use. And on top of that, why would you suggest something like that in the immediate wake of Spence struggling against Sean Porter, where we know it's a sport that, like, literally anything can happen, where they're talking 2 years ago about marinating Anthony Joshua versus fucking Deontay Wilder, and here we are. I mean,
yeah.
I do understand it, but I guess just colloquially, you know, rhetorically, I don't understand it, because it's so stupid. And especially when it could potentially open the door, Spence Crawford, that is, for other fights. Like, if that's a great fight, you could rematch that fight. It's just numb, dude. That's the fight to make. And anybody arguing that that's not the fight to make, in my opinion, that's not a boxing fan. Anybody making excuses for Premier Boxing champions pushing for Errol Spence to fight Danny Garcia next, who Danny Garcia has almost zero credentials at 147 pounds. Like, I'm not saying that to be a jerk or to be funny or to make a point or something. It's true. He does not have very impressive credentials at 147 pounds. So to argue whether, regardless of any belt and who gives a shit about the belts, to argue that that's the fight that should happen next, like, that's not like your boxing friend. That's somebody who's a mouthpiece for somebody who's paying them. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I mean, look at this fight Saturday. A perfect indicator. Golovkin's opponent.
There you go.
Sergey Derevyanchenko is making $5.5 million to fight Golovkin. So, like, try to make sense of that for me. Like, if that's the structure, the financial structure that we've created for boxing, that Golovkin can fight an opponent where he's got this massive deal that he's working from to fight an opponent that nobody in the United States has ever heard of, right? I mean, realistically, I'm not taking anything away from him, but, like, okay, you've got a 13-1 opponent from the Ukraine that is going to bring in zero audience, who's making $5.5 million to get, like, fucking probably just trashed by Golovkin.
Okay. And that's exactly it's so indicative of, like, we were talking about in the preview, and I apologize for interrupting you, but it relates directly to what we were talking about in the preview and the pay structure and scale and how overpaying fighters in certain situations can directly affect what other fighters, even on other networks, are going to get paid in the future. And we're seeing that now.
Yep. And I just don't understand. I mean, $5.5 million. I mean, how much did Andy Ruiz get paid to fight Joshua? I don't think he made $2 million for that fight. I could be wrong, but my memory was that he didn't make much for stepping into that position to take that fight. I mean, I can check it. What's your memory of what Ruiz made?
Let me see. I'm going to have to look. Does it say?
So Miller's purse with DAZN was to be $4.87 million. So I don't
Holy
know
shit.
Necessarily Ruiz would get the same for it. But, like, what does that say? That, like, fucking Ruiz is fighting one of the most marketable athletes in the world and makes less than this nobody fighting fucking Golovkin.
Yeah, I mean, well, and I would imagine that they probably didn't just change, I don't know for sure, but they probably didn't just put Andy Ruiz Jr. name into Gerald Miller's name on the contract. He probably took a chunk out of that, you know? So, and especially when, obviously incorrectly, so many of us expected Andy Ruiz Jr. to not be able to rise to the occasion and probably be a lesser foe than Gerald Miller. Again, we were wrong, but that was the perception. So, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make sense.
Jeez, I'm seeing that Ruiz made $7 million for that fight, according to the Wall Street Journal.
Wow, okay.
Fight?
Well, even that being the case, it still doesn't make it any more logical what's happening this week. You know, that doesn't really. I mean, you could be wrong, but it doesn't really have any bearing on what we're talking about, how the pay scale and structure gets affected. I mean, one of the things that I'd started out saying on the episode right before you'd gotten on was that we were going to at least talk or give it a little preview of Gennady Golovkin versus Sergey Derevyanchenko, but I said it was a highly respectable fight because I think it is. I think it's a fight where Gennady Golovkin is possibly matched a little bit more difficult than a lot of people realize because they're not familiar with Sergey Derevyanchenko, or at least not that familiar beyond his fight against Daniel Jacobs. But he's a very skilled guy. He's not a guy that Gennady Golovkin's likely to look super good against, he's probably not going to look dynamite. That is, Derevyanchenko is a very skilled guy who's good at taking away the strength of his opponents, and he's a good boxer. So this is a highly risky fight for that reason. And it could wind up being a bit of a backfire, especially in the wake of Spence Porter, which was a really good fight. If this fight this weekend doesn't wind up being all that entertaining, or something bad happens, something unexpected happens, I'm not saying I agree. I'm not saying that you need to then trash PBC or trash DAZN and then jump on the PBC bandwagon. But it sure seems like in the last few months, the momentum has been clearly with DAZN, and not so much with ESPN Plus. Sorry, ESPN Plus, your program has been shite, and I can't even get onto your damn app on any of my things anyway. Constantly kicks me off. But clearly on DAZN, that, and on top of that, their end-of-the-year schedule looks pretty good. But if it doesn't wind up producing this weekend, doesn't mean everything's, you know, baby out with the bathwater, but Gennady Golovkin's clearly one of the bigger stars, or at least was marketed as one of the bigger stars to join DAZN. And, you know, it's already seeming like their structure for building this kind of network on the back of a number of these stars is not looking super sturdy, because Anthony Joshua was the second, first, whatever, however you want to measure it, biggest star on their network. He got smashed. Canelo is clearly at odds with the people at DAZN who want certain fights to happen, because everything that I'm reading and hearing is that, you know, DAZN wants the Golovkin trilogy, Golden Boy wants the Golovkin trilogy, pretty much everybody but Canelo wants it. And how are they going to make him take it? I don't know. So it's kind of a precarious situation, I think, because DAZN hasn't really emerged with a ton of new stars. They basically have those guys and the tournaments, and a couple of those tournaments have also gone south a little bit. It's a very strange situation. I mean, at the end of the day, all I really want, like you said earlier, I just want good fights. I want to be entertained. I want the fighters to be taken care of, and we are kind of romantics in that regard, but nonetheless, I do care about these things. I do care about the future of the sport and what these things are going to mean for it.
Yeah, and I mean, I really like Golovkin. I like what he's accomplished in his career. Thrilling fighter. And he's also, at this point, older than Lennox Lewis was when Lewis retired. So you want to throw you know, hundreds of millions of dollars at that guy, okay. But I also wouldn't mind if maybe boxing wasn't taking that approach to, like, so much emphasis on strongest link people in the sport, and might look at, as you say, like, fostering up-and-comers, making an attempt to develop new stars to, you know, create shoulder programming so there's more recognition in the sport. Like, I love having Canelo be the face of the sport. I love the kind of fights that he usually puts on, the challenges he's taken. But we could use some more stars, and I think, like, we're producing them. And, you know, we're also producing increasingly, like, boxing has a Latino fan base, and we're producing some tremendous Hispanic fighters. I mean, we have the first Mexican-American heavyweight champion. I'm just kind of struck by just how stale the model seems to be in terms of developing these guys. Like, we're not developing the same crop of people that we were 30 years ago. It's different, but I mean, it's different in a way that reflects the country right now. And yet it doesn't seem like the marketing has evolved to really, I don't know, assist that and to help facilitate that in a way that just seems like pretty intuitive to do. But, you know, it just still seems like the same fucking pony show in a lot of ways. And you know, you've got all these dinosaurs everywhere in boxing who are still in charge other than Eddie Hearn. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if fresh blood is the answer, but it's weird. Like, I'm happy to go see Golovkin fight tomorrow where I live and get a press credential to go see it. But this is where you want to put somebody like Golovkin at 37 years old, like, fighting somebody that nobody knows. And probably the major takeaway as far as media is going to be that this sold like shit in terms of tickets, and probably sold like shit in terms of subscribers. You know, like, this is not a winner, and they're paying a huge amount of money for this. And when you go to these sort of, like, promotional things that you get invited, it's like you're supposed to pretend to be really enthusiastic about it, and there's nothing to be enthusiastic about. And that's frustrating seems to be the word of the day, but it is frustrating. Like, it's embarrassing in a lot of ways.
In the I can't remember exactly who it was. It might have been Jay Larkin or somebody, but in the 2000s, I think it was in part a little bit of, like, a rebellious move, kind of a contrarian thing, maybe a response to HBO clearly pulling well ahead in the you know, who's the shit in boxing polls. But Showtime essentially came up with this idea that, look, dude, we're not going to be signing fighters anymore. We're not in the business of signing fighters. We're going to be doing, what was the slogan? Fights, not fighters. Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And they had repeated that, and that was kind of their mantra for a number of years. And I think it really worked. At least from an action perspective, from a fan perspective, they were able to do a lot of things on Showtime with some really good cruiserweights in the 2000s, et cetera. You know, they were the ones who actively pursued the lightweight division with Jose Luis Castillo and Diego Corrales, Joel Casamayor, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the list goes on. Also, well, and I'm sorry, one thing I do have to mention there is Rafa Marquez versus Israel Vasquez. Showtime was the one who really pursued those fights when HBO was like, nah, we don't need that shit. Hey, dude, that's massive. Those fights, that's not including the fourth fight, obviously, the first three fights, one of the greatest trilogies in boxing. So it's a plan that really worked from the perspective of it being entertaining, for it being good for boxing and good for the fans. But obviously, it didn't wind up bearing out financially, because the best way to financially do it is the way that they're doing now, is they're riding on the backs of these bigger stars, or guys that they've tried to make bigger stars, Gennady Golovkin included. You know, he kind of came from nowhere, and in a lot of ways, he's a massive success story in that regard. So, you know, they've really gotten away from any sort of model like that. And yeah, they do need to invest more in younger fighters, and they do need to invest more in local and club shows. That is that. I mean, I don't think there could be any sort of argument against that. One of the things that I've noticed in the last few years, especially being here in the Portland area and seeing Steve 2 Pound Forbes really grow and work really hard to put his company 2 Pound Promotions into play in this area, is that there is so much local talent, not just here, not just in Portland and Vancouver and, you know, southwestern Washington, but there's local talent in New York. There's local talent outside, just outside of New York. There's local talent in Providence. There's local talent in Boston. You know, Ken Casey from the Dropkick Murphys, he's been doing some shit in Boston. That's one thing that I really wish, and I do have to give some credit to Golden Boy Promotions. You know, I talk a lot of shit about some of the stuff they do because Oscar's a total moron, and you know, like some of the decisions they make are totally laughable. But one thing they have done, whether it's out of necessity or not, is they have reinvested some of their money in a lot of young talent, and they've known where to do it as well. They've gone to Texas, along border towns, Arizona, California, obviously, and they have really gone after a lot of younger fighters who are local type of guys and tried to make something of that. And that's kind of a formula that's like almost being lost. It's like body punching. It's like with every generation, it slips away a little bit because the other things that are more glamorous or whatever are taking its place. And it's really unfortunate. And I think that focusing on local talent, young talent, not necessarily relying on these dudes who are 30, 31, 32, 37, and just saying these are the stars and these are the ones we're going to, you know, plant the roots on, it's not super helpful in the long run. It might be lucrative, but where is Gennady Golovkin going to be if, say, Sergey Derevyanchenko this weekend undresses his ass, outboxes him?
Right, right.
Or even loses to him but makes him look horrible.
Right.
You know, there's already a faction of people who are kind of categorically against the fact that Gennady Golovkin has gotten as much hype as he is, regardless of how good he is. Do you know what I mean? Like, they just hate the popular,
mm-hmm.
which I get.
Yeah.
But he's kind of fighting an uphill battle on top of the fact that he's 37. So it's very risky, and I do wish there were a little bit more investment into other guys and girls, for that matter.
Yeah. And I mean, we haven't touched on the Clarissa Shields fiasco today.
Jesus.
With her crew, but like that's bad look. Jesus
that's,
Christ, sucker
yeah,
punching.
Well, so for anybody who's, you know, listening in at this point, by the time you listen in, you'll probably know exactly what the hell Bryn's talking about. But at the weigh-in for Clarissa Shields is fighting on, gosh, what's his name? Yuri Foreman, I believe, is the promoter, the former fighter turned promoter. She's fighting on that card, and she's fighting against Habazin Ivana, or Ivana Habazin, I'm not sure. Sometimes they mix them up, and then makes me look stupid. But regardless, they were jawing at each other. Somebody in Clarissa Shields' posse, entourage, whatever, started yelling at somebody in her opponent's corner, and then a couple minutes afterwards, all of a sudden, I think it was Clarissa Shields' opponent's trainer got punched in like the back of the head as he wasn't looking by whoever it was that was yelling at him in Clarissa Shields' like, dude, come on. What I think that makes it look extra special, fucking asshole-ish on Clarissa Shields' part, even though it wasn't her who did it, was that about a year and a half ago, whenever it was that Leon Lawson sucker-punched Jose Uzcategui in the corner, Clarissa Shields almost immediately took to social media defending Leon Lawson and basically telling people, you don't know how it is, you know, you're not a fighter, you're blah, blah, blah. And ostensibly because she's also from Flint and, you know, I'm sure they all know each other and stuff like that, but man, that makes it look extra especially crappy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really bad, and it looks like, from what I've sort of detected on social media, the fight is in doubt. It hasn't been canceled yet, but there's some reporting that that's definitely being discussed.
Yeah.
And this was the trainer of her opponent who sucker punched and taken away on a stretcher to the hospital. This is a bad look, and I mean, this is part of the deal with the people. You know, I see all the time Mark Tappet on social media trumpeting everything that Shields does to get as much attention as possible. And, you know, every press conference I've gone to of hers, the tenor of her comments is just everybody's against her. Everybody's against her. And it's like she has had so much publicity supporting her and acknowledging her and celebrating her. But there's just like a real chip on her shoulder, and you think, like, I don't know, just, I mean, she didn't do this, but this is a member of her camp, and from the videos I've seen, I mean, she's not really discouraging the lead up to the violence, and ultimately, like, she's going to be the one who suffers for this, right? Like, I mean, it's a little bit on her. This is her camp. This is her group of people that she's assembled, and I don't know. I mean, I really admire what she's accomplished. I understand how much of an uphill battle it is in a very misogynistic sport, you know, where female fighters have been denigrated for a long time. But this is, I mean, how many fights have we seen where a fucking trainer has been sucker punched and taken away on a stretcher? This is bad. This is really, really just a bad, bad look.
Well, and actually, one thing I forgot to mention in regards to, but I'll respond in just a sec, but one thing I don't want to forget about is that apparently, I don't know what exactly happened, but apparently this morning they did kind of a closed-door weigh-in for Golovkin and Derevianchenko, where the press was, like, kicked out and not allowed, and then they reported the... I mean, I've heard of things like that happening before, but usually not for a big fight. So I don't know what happened, but apparently they both made weight. I don't know what's going on. But anyway, I think that I'm happy that you brought that up about Clarissa Shields that way. And especially because of what we were talking about earlier in regard to Spence Porter and basically just having some nuance about the goddamn discussion rather than just saying it was good, period, it was bad, period, and then that's the only fucking way you can play it. There is nuance to it. You know, you can live in a world where you're pissed off at the price tag but happy that the event was good. You know, that you're pissed off that Spence Crawford is probably not going to happen but still content at the fact that, you know, the pay-per-view actually wound up being very entertaining. You know, all of these things can exist together. And applying that to Clarissa Shields, for instance, I see not like every day, but, you know, frequently enough, I see a lot of high-level reporters. I see a lot of people who are boxing media people, pundits, whatever, talking shit in a way that makes it seem as though they specifically are singling Clarissa Shields out because either she's a woman or she's black or because she's a black woman. I don't know. And I'm not saying that that's the case. I'm just saying that that definitely is what it looks like. And because of that, I have definitely shied away from any of that kind of discussion. I'm not interested in it. I'm purely interested in assessing her as a fighter. I definitely have sympathy for her story. And I know that she's been through a lot and that's awful. And I think that she has a very interesting story that probably just hasn't been told quite the right way yet, because it is a very resonant story and it is a story that's important. But I can feel all those things and feel sympathy for the fact that she does get ganged up on. And it seems like a massive dog pile on her when shit starts going in social media. So I can feel that way, but still be incredibly disappointed and annoyed by the fact that she apparently is one of the kinds of people who feels as though they have to manufacture haters in their life. They have to pretend that they have all of these enemies, when in reality, the reality is that most people don't know who you are. Even fewer people know who the fuck I am. You know, I mean, but most people don't know who you are. So to pretend as though every person who's walking in your city fucking hates your ass is a bit much and probably points to some major insecurities. Does that matter in the ring? Eh, I don't know. I guess we'll have to see. I think she's a very good fighter, but I also don't think she's nearly as good as she thinks she is. And I think that there's the potential for a handful of other women fighters to show her that. So it's a nuanced discussion, and I don't want to dismiss her, but that it's super shitty what happened today. And also in the context of her speaking that way and kind of going overboard with the kind of like threatening type of shit. And then on top of that, defending the thug shit, the grimy shit, like Leon Lawson did and like whoever it was did to her opponent's trainer today. It's bad news, man, and it is going to reflect on her, like you said.
Well, and I think, I mean, just putting, you know, that the big narrative she's putting out is for, you know, equality of pay regardless of gender. And, you know, it's just, I just don't think boxing with men and women is the same thing that it is with tennis. I don't think it's the same thing. You know, I think what Ronda Rousey proved in MMA was not just, like, I get the racism angle that we're talking about a blonde-haired woman who, you know, people wanted to see naked in magazines and stuff like that. I mean, she was posing in the ESPN body issue and stuff. And I mean, so by the way, did Clarissa Shields. But, you know, conforming more to a patriarchal, like white society's ideal of beauty, the manufactured ideal of beauty, Rousey. But the other thing is that she fucking knocked out everybody in tremendously exciting ways. And while Clarissa Shields in the lead up to every single fight talks about how she's going to annihilate whoever her opponent is, she doesn't. She doesn't knock out all of her opponents. She doesn't knock out almost any of her opponents. Whereas Rousey did. There was, you know, I'm not even an MMA fan. I'm pretty, not anti-MMA. I mean, I'm indifferent. But there was a dynamic to the tension and suspense that Rousey could create with her fights that in victory and in defeat were must watch. You had to see it because of kind of the character that she created and the way that character fought. And when I've gone to press conferences with Shields, I'm just struck by the moment she gets in front of the microphone, it's just calling out the media for just, we've always been against her, we've always doubted her, and on and on. And it's like, really? Like, you've been front page
like, we're here now.
All over the place.
What do you mean? Yeah, we're here like, now.
Well, not just here now, but, like, you've had more press coverage than, like, there are times where, like, you're getting as much coverage as a lot of major male athletes, and it's hugely because your story is amazingly compelling. You are a two-time Olympic champion. You are undefeated. And guess what? In terms of the market, you're not marketable. You're not selling tickets. You're not selling pay-per-views. You're not a character that really is causing people to see what you're going to do next. And part of that is you. And part of that is, unfortunately, that the opponents are not people that we're afraid that you're going to get beat. And we're not that excited about you beating them either. And I just would like there to be a slight acknowledgement about some of those other dynamics on top of racism and sexism, which I'm totally acknowledging are there. They are currents that she's swimming against to try to find success. But you could also say, I have had a huge amount of exposure, and maybe say, like, why haven't I translated the way Serena Williams has or Venus Williams or Ronda Rousey and these kind of people? Like, is it something that I might be doing wrong, or is it all everybody else's fault sort of thing? And I don't know what the answer is to any of that. I'm just saying, when you go and say that everybody is against you and you have this tremendous persecution complex, objectively speaking, I can show you 9 million ways where a lot of people have gone to great extents to try to showcase you to as many people as they possibly can. And it hasn't really done anything. Like, you know, as you're saying, she's not really known. I don't even know that she's really known in the sport in a lot of ways, let alone transcending the sport. And she's in a lot of places, both in film, you know, Netflix documentaries and ESPN magazines and major profiles and all of that. And it's like, oh, that's great. It's great she's doing it. But there's something about it that's one note. And I don't know why it is, because her story is anything but one note. But there's something about it. And you're right. Maybe the fault is the media not being able to cover the story properly. But I wonder why, you know, and now this will become the big narrative about her. Like, this is the most recent chapter, is that she's participating in a fight at a weigh-in that gets canceled because one of the people from her team punches out the fucking aging trainer of her opponent. Awesome. You know, great. So I don't know. And this was a fight that sold a lot of tickets in her hometown. So it's frustrating, because I want her to succeed, but I think a lot of her attitude makes it difficult. And, you know, again, you can't bring that up without the weight of all of these other forces that are involved in her story, which I readily acknowledge. But just saying, interacting with her, and I haven't directly interacted with her in terms of asking questions. I have sought to do a profile on her once, like while she was training out at the junior Olympic facility in Colorado. And it wasn't that easy to set it up. And you know, a lot of editors that I reached out to, their point was just like, yeah, it's been done. Like who cares? Like, it's not worth it. And I just thought, fuck, like that's so frustrating. 'Cause I'd love a crack at trying to do the best I could to try to help get her story out there. But it reminded me a lot of Andre Ward. Andre Ward, like, gave me a lot of scooped material, and guess what? Nobody gave a fuck. They just didn't give a fuck. And it's not because the material itself is not compelling. It was very compelling. He's not compelling. He's just not. And he's compelling to me, but he certainly wasn't compelling to other people. I've never had a profile I've done on somebody where there was a bunch of new material and, you know, and a very celebrated athlete, and nobody gave a flying fuck about it. You know, and nobody really gave a fuck in terms of buying tickets or pay-per-views for him in his entire career either. So it was totally in line with that. So I just hope, and I know from Ward also that Shields was reaching out to him a lot about how to guide her career as a public figure. I thought, I don't know if you want to go to this guy as the person who's steering you, because he made out all right, but, you know, for every Ward who can make a very good living approaching his career the way he did, there's going to be 1,000 guys who do not do well. You know, and they're nowhere near as good boxers as Ward was, but just his way of handling the media and the chip on his shoulder, it was not easy to make him sellable, and it took some real talent to not make him sellable.
Well, and I think that it's interesting that you brought up Ronda Rousey. Of course, the inference to some might be that, well, she's white, so yeah. But nonetheless, sure. I think that you bring up a really important point there. And, you know, perhaps we could also look at it like this. I'm not into professional wrestling, but enough of the people that I am either acquaintances with or follow or whatever on Twitter are to know that, you know, Ronda Rousey has gone on to be fairly successful in professional wrestling now. And so you kind of have to ask, well, what about Clarissa Shields? Could you see her going forward, leaving boxing and being successful in professional wrestling, for instance? No, because she has not created a character, or is not herself enough of a compelling character that it's even interesting. You know, even with Ronda Rousey, at least from what I gather, a lot of the, you know, the feeling is that, like, you know, perhaps, you know, she's kind of like annoying, and that annoyance is also what drives the sales, you know? And even so, it's like most people just don't care about Clarissa Shields, like you said. And I mean, it's unfortunate. I wish that weren't the case, but that also has to factor into the payment issue too, like many people say. I do want to see women get equal pay as much as possible, but you know, when nobody really wants to watch to that degree, it's very difficult to argue the other way.
Well, no, and I mean, I think the thing with Rousey also is, you know, I don't know many athletes like in the 20th century where them succeeding is the most successful thing they do, and them failing is the second most compelling thing in the sport. That's true of Babe Ruth. That was often true of Muhammad Ali. I think it was true of Ronda Rousey in MMA. And I mean, look at this. I mean, that she is the face of a sport that was wildly misogynistic from the top down. And in a very brief amount of time, based on the character she created and the kind of fights, you know, the dominant role that she played in that sport, she was bigger than any man that they've ever had in the history of that sport, by far, by far. And even when she lost, she was even more I mean, it was as close as that sport ever had to Tyson Douglas when she lost that first time. And I don't think anybody's looking back at that like, boy, what were we thinking? That was so misplaced, you know, and all that. Yeah, there was a little bit of talk that maybe she was overrated or whatever. But at the same time, like, those were incredibly dramatic moments and suspenseful moments to see her rise, to see her dominance, and to see her fall. And I don't see any of those narratives having any kind of traction with Clarissa Shields. When she wins, she's got 9 wins, she has 2 knockouts. None of the fights have been particularly memorable. If she lost, you'd kind of be like, yeah, okay, she's not there anymore.
And so, sorry to interrupt you, but it looks like the fight just got called off. Like it's officially off now because it sounds like, well, and not like yay, but it sounds like from what I'm kind of gathering that her opponent's trainer actually has to go in for emergency surgery now. So not a real good look. And I hope he winds up being okay, of course.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. And I mean, and another thing with her is that, like, if this is the – I'm not saying this is, but I'm just saying totally hypothetically. If this is, like, the derailment of all of her success, I don't think a lot of people care about that either. And I just don't know. It's a frustrating, there's a lot of talent there. There's a lot of opportunity for her to assume a role that could make her a lot of money and be good for the sport. But like, here we are, like this 24-year-old 2-time Olympic champion, undefeated world champion. And what's going to be the dominant note of her narrative now? Potentially this guy getting killed from a fucking sucker punch after a weigh-in press conference. Great.
Yeah, well, and, you know, and the primary concern is his health, you know, that he winds up being okay, obviously. But nonetheless, it's not a good look for boxing either. You know, I don't want to make it about that. And I don't want to be like, oh, poor me, I'm not going to have my boxing in a year now. But it's yet another just a reason why people look down on it, let down their nose at it sometimes. It's tough, man. I hope he winds up being okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in no way are we talking in any way about a commentary about women's boxing. I think like the Serrano-Hardy fight that I was at, even though it was a very one-sided contest, was really exciting. Serrano is one of the most exciting fighters, I think, in all of boxing. And regardless of gender, she's a real talent. I just think Shields is just one of those characters, as I say, like Andre Ward. It seems similar to me, where it's complicated. It's disturbing that somebody, you know, or Larry Holmes is another great example of a champion where nobody denies what they've done and, you know, what they've accomplished. But for the most part, people are just kind of like, yeah, it's just not exciting. It's not dramatic. And, you know, we haven't, I don't recall that we've really brought up Shields a lot, and maybe we are being, or maybe I'm being a little too hard on her, but I don't wish her failure. It just seems like there's some self-sabotage in the approach that she's taking in navigating her career, which I find frustrating, because I would like her to succeed, and I think she is a great talent, but I came away from some of the encounters I had at press conferences, which is meant to try to get us reporters interested to tell her story. And, you know, like one of the favorite things I've ever written was about a female writer, Melissa Saintville, and her run in with Roger Mayweather, you know, attacking her, violently attacking her and stuff. And it was incredible to see her tell her story, and, you know, it was one of the best stories that I've ever had shared to me from a boxer. And a lot of it was because, like, I think the way what women are up against in participating in the sport, there are so many obstacles to it that men don't even completely take for granted. It was a similar thing with Cuban fighters coming over, where people are like, well, they have this attitude and they have this and that. It's like, because it's different for them. Like, look what they had to do just to get here. Like, no American has to do any of that. So, of course, you can't understand or appreciate human smuggling operations to get you to Mexico and then crossing the border into the U.S. And there was something similar with Melissa Saintville talking about, you know, trying to get respect and stuff like that. But, you know, and I also saw the response to that, just her talking out about Roger Mayweather beating her and choking her to death.
Right.
There was a lot of people on social media, on like the YouTube that was with Vice, a little short documentary I did about her, who were like, he wouldn't have done that unless she was fucking him. She's lying. You know, just straight up fucking misogyny, laying into her. Like, as if this guy, like, and his family don't have a massive record of attacking women. And it didn't matter what the evidence was. It was just, come on, she's manipulative and she's going for money. And, like, it was ugly. Like, it was just, yeah.
Well, needless to say, you know, I'd not to just repeat it, but I hope that her opponent's trainer winds up being okay, because that's getting sucker punched, you know? Well, any type of punch, whatever, it's shitty. And it sounds like the card itself, the Showtime card, is going to be going forward, but holy shit, as kind of an offshoot here, how quickly has Showtime just taken a nosedive in the boxing department, dude? A couple months ago, I went ahead and like was like, all right, you know what? I'm sick of like tracking down streams for this shit. I'm just going to pay the like $5 a month so that I can watch the damn live boxing. Dude, I'm going to cancel the shit out of that, man. And I don't mean to like pivot so quickly away from something important we were talking about, but goddamn.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's a narrative that gets brought up every time I'm with other reporters, is just laughing that, not laughing, but just making the point that you are, that Showtime is headed exactly where HBO went. And yeah, it just makes it all the more important that the money that's available right now go to the right places, to, you know, while it's there, to assist the sport and its longevity and nurturing another crop of great fighters to keep the sport healthy. And I don't really see that. I don't really see that. And I certainly don't see it with this fucking Golovkin fight. And it could be a lot worse if Golovkin happens to lose and get old overnight and, you know, look washed up, or just meet the wrong guy at the wrong time and get beat. Probably that's not going to happen. But, yeah.
Well, hopefully we wind up with a good, you know, weekend of boxing. We had a pretty good weekend of boxing, you know, despite the complaints. We had a pretty good weekend of boxing last weekend. So hopefully we wind up with something pretty good this weekend, too. But yeah, I mean, I guess the main takeaway is $75 bad, Spence Porter good.
Yep.
Purses for Golovkin, Derevianchenko bad. Possible action good. Clarissa Shields, posse punching
good.
Somebody very bad. So
yeah.
I think that's a good sum up.
Yeah, Clarissa Shields good, Posse not as good.
Posse awful, apparently.
Posse pretty awful.
Good God. Anyway, everybody, if you actually listened in for this entire time while we relentlessly talk shit. No, we were actually fairly positive. We do appreciate it, though. We appreciate you listening in. And if you wouldn't mind, if you're on Twitter, go follow Bryn Jonathan Butler on Twitter at Brynicio, B-R-I-N-I-C-I-O. Follow me, Patrick Connor at Patrick M. Connor. If you're on Facebook, if you wouldn't mind going to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page there, giving it a like, that'd be cool. And all sorts of new little apps to listen to podcasts now. And whichever one you use, go on there, rate us, give us a thumbs up, however they work. I don't even know, man. I'm starting to get old. Right?
Well, I mean, and the other thing is Bobby Chance. I mean,
I was going to say, ask Bobby. If you don't know how to do this, go contact Bobby. He knows.
He knows. And you know, if you're willing to accept him as your Uber driver, you're a braver man than me or Patrick.
I agree. I'd think he'd be more of a, I don't know. He might be more of a Lyft guy, but I don't know. It's tough to say.
Tough to say, but I'm sure there's some liquor company out there that needs to sponsor that right away. And best of luck to you.
Drink responsibly, my friends.
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, we need to go to the Boxing Hall of Fame and make a formal request to get those boots that somebody sent us a photograph of. That was amazing.
Yeah, that was Zach Alapi, who's written for a number of different websites. He's written for Fox and stuff like that. So thank you, Zach. I'm sure you're listening in then. If you know the Chez jokes, you're listening in. Thanks for the thanks for actually sending us the photo from the Hall of Fame. That's high quality shit there, buddy.
It was. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Thanks so much. We'll be back next time. Bryn, I'll talk to you soon, bro.
You got it, man. Take care. Take care, everybody.
Later, everybody.